Anybody here who likes to be judged? Never met anybody that does. There's a big thing in our culture, isn't there, about judgment. You can do anything you like, anything really, as long as you don't judge anybody. That's the worst thing you can possibly do. Or even as long as people don't feel judged. That's even worse, apparently. Sometimes you don't even say anything and people feel judged these days. It's a complete minefield. I've got myself into trouble loads of times by not saying anything in front of people and then feeling judged. Why is this a problem? What is it about judgment that we hate so much? Why don't we like it? For me, I hate the idea that someone presumes to know my motives and my thoughts and they get me wrong. Sometimes my wife does this. Don't worry, darling. She's put her head up. And if she's wrong, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. In fact, it's sort of enjoyable. So she has such a low expectation of me, which is really warranted, I have to say. And she'll answer her own question. She'll go, did you put the dishwasher on? No. And if I did, it's great. I go, ah-ha-ha, actually, yes, ye of little faith. I think if you walk into the kitchen right now, you will see it's mid-cycle because I put it on. It's really satisfying. That sort of judgment is one thing. But what's far more difficult is when somebody's completely on the money. That's a lot harder. When someone judges you and they're right. So like when Naomi says, you went for a run and you left all your sweaty clothes on the bathroom floor and you know that I hate that. Yep. Can't deny it. I have no defense other than my own abject laziness. It's not my fault, it's a condition. No, it is my fault. And this is just small stuff. But with big stuff, nobody likes being judged, do they? Nobody likes to be judged. When someone pulls a face that says they disapprove of your opinion or your political view or a big choice you made, it doesn't feel good. It feels minimizing, like you're not valid in some way. And it's even worse when you know there's some truth in what they're saying or thinking. It's much worse. One of the big struggles people have with Christianity, even that Christians have with Christianity, is the idea that God judges us. The Bible teaches that God judges us at least in part in this life, but there's a time when each of us will be judged in full based on God's survey of our lives. We're doing this series at the moment called Snapshots, looking at short and often neglected bits of the Bible. And one of the bits that I think is often neglected is the Old Testament book of Nahum. We're going to look at Nahum today. Maybe one reason it's neglected is that it's very heavy on God judging people. In fact, Nahum doesn't really say a lot else. It's just three chapters of God talking about judging people. And that's why I thought it'd be lots of fun to have a look at it this morning. It's a bit long to read, so what we're going to do is zoom in on a few verses and what they tell us about judgment. Now, by way of some context, the book of Nahum is the words of a man called Nahum around probably 620 BC. Nahum was from the tiny nation of Israel, which had suffered at the hands of the huge and violent Assyrian Empire. And Nahum spoke against the Assyrians to tell them, guys, God has seen what you've done, and he's going to act against you. And he has very strong words in particular for Nineveh, which was the capital city of the empire. Nahum was what is called a prophet, a sort of mouthpiece for God, and there's a load of them in the Old Testament. And Nahum's words, when he actually spoke originally, were probably not given that much attention at the time. But years later, with hindsight, you could see that everything that he'd said would happen to Nineveh did. And that made people take notice and come to believe that the God Nahum represents in these words is the true God. These messages for real. So let's see what it's about. Here's three big ideas from Nahum. Firstly, judgment is coming. Nahum starts by making it very clear that judgment is coming. And here are his words. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and vents his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger, but great in power. The Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. His way is in the whirlwind and the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. These are not easy verses to read, are they? God is jealous, and he avenges, and he's full of wrath. Not easy things. And we have to remember, this message was addressed to the Assyrians after literally centuries of appalling behavior. They invaded and slaughtered and ransacked people like there was no tomorrow. God knew every moment of every action of every individual. And That's why it says God is slow to anger. I actually imagine a lot of Assyria's victims would have liked him to be a little bit quicker. God doesn't want to be angry. He doesn't enjoy being angry, but it's appropriate that he's angry, and not just with the Assyrians. Think about what makes you angry. Sometimes all of us get angry for the wrong reasons. Of course, that's another story. But sometimes we're angry for the right reasons. Someone lies to you, you're angry. Someone swindles you out of money, you're angry. You turn on the TV, you see that somebody blew themselves up and killed a load of people. It doesn't even affect you directly, but you're angry. And that's all appropriate. If you don't get angry ever, you don't care. And that can't be good. God gets angry because he cares deeply. If you or I, with our limited perspective and our flaws, get angry, how much more does God, who is perfect and far more invested in people than we ever could be? He gets angry, not sort of petulant, I didn't get my way, I'm going to have a tantrum sort of angry, but the anger that comes from being deeply rejected and hurt. His anger is not like ours. That's really important. I think a lot of people struggle with God's anger because we fear that he's angry in the way that other people we know are angry. And we've all come across people who are angry for seemingly no reason, or they're disproportionately angry and it's out of control. Maybe some of us have experienced at the hands of somebody else great anger that wasn't justified. And if we've experienced anger like that and we marry it with the sheer amount of power that God has, that's very scary. But God isn't like us. He will never get angry without reason. He won't randomly lash out. In fact, God's anger is entirely predictable. It's entirely predictable. We'll come back to that later. But when he's angry, he responds. He's slow to anger, but eventually he acts. If you read the rest of this book of Nahum, there's loads of imagery to describe it, like a whirlwind or a storm, things like that. In fact, there's loads of stuff like this in the Old Testament. You can't get away from it. And it's not because God revels in this and he enjoys it. It's because the big human problem is our rejection of him, our sin. We constantly push him towards anger because even though he's patient, and even though in that anger God warns people over and over again, we keep going. He's warned the Assyrians repeatedly by this point, and now he's saying, it's the end of the line. Now judgment is coming, and it will be painful, and it will be final. In our culture, we tend to be very uncomfortable with the idea that God judges, don't we? Many cultures completely understand why God would judge, but they find it unbelievable that he would love us. Us Westerners love the idea that God loves. And it's true, he does. He does. We love Bible verses about his kindness and his patience and his generosity and how he keeps his promises, and they're all true. Don't worry, they're all true. But we don't love the verses about God's anger and judgment. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. Anybody ever written that in a birthday card? No? Got it on your fridge? No. For us, the idea that God loves and the idea that God judges seem at odds. It sounds like there's two departments of God, the nice department and the not so nice department, and they're sort of in competition. That's not the case. God judges because he loves. Love is still the headline. If you want to describe God's character, his way of dealing with humanity in one word, it's still love. It's still love. It's the best one-word summary. But if we think his judgment contradicts that, we haven't understood God right. We've missed something with God. And Nahum's telling us he judges because he loves, and his judgment is coming. Second thing, there's a division line. There's a division line. We might think, okay, if God judges everything, what's the criteria? How does anybody know where they stand? How do I get to be okay? Nahum says this, 1 verses 7 to 8. The Lord is good, a refuge in times of trouble. He cares for those who trust in him, but with an overwhelming flood, he will make an end of Nineveh. He will pursue his foes into the realm of darkness. Another fridge magnet one. This is interesting because it's really clear. There's no fuzzy in-between gray area. You're on God's team or you're not. And yet, there's no tick list. There's no lengthy set of rules. Now, of course, elsewhere in the Bible, there's plenty of things where God makes it clear how he wants people to live. That's true. But here, in the heat of God's anger, expressed to people who've lived very wrongly, he doesn't pull out a rule book. It's all expressed in relational terms. You're God's friend or his foe. The dividing line isn't a set of laws. It's not even really about your behavior when it comes down to it. The issue is, do you place trust in him or not? Do you place trust in him? It's a relational term. When you trust someone, you listen to them, you include them. You believe they have your best interests. You honor what they say. And it's hard to put into a list of do's and don'ts. But you know when you're doing it with somebody and when you're not. You know. The Assyrians, who were the bad guys in this text, had a big cultural emphasis on trust. They placed their trust in various other gods. At the time that this was written, Nineveh was a big, powerful city. You could say in some senses it was the center of the world. The Assyrians were the biggest empire in the world. Trusting in their gods, at least on a practical level, seemed to be working. They were fine. It was working for them. It wasn't so good for everybody else, but it was working for them. But Nahum is here to tell them it's not going to last forever. Empires never do. They can go on for a while, but God doesn't let any empire in history last forever, however strong it gets. And that's true for big international empires like Assyria, and it's true for personal empires like the ones that you and I have. Empires don't go on forever. So God is good, and yet if you don't trust him, you're in trouble. Here it says God pursues his foes into the realm of darkness. And this is where we get a hint. Nahum gives us a hint, which is fleshed out much more elsewhere, of the concept of hell, the ultimate place of darkness, another word that we love to avoid. Maybe we can get on board with the idea of some sort of judgment. Okay, I understand that. But hell, the thought of a place of permanent darkness, which does come from the Bible, doesn't sound like a loving God either. Doesn't sound very loving, does it? Let's think it through, though. Most people, when they think of the word hell, think that it works like this. God gives you a bit of time, but if you choose wrong by the end of your life, you get cast into hell for eternity, and it's full of fire and pitchforks and devils, and God stands at a distance with his arms folded and said, well, told you, should have listened to me. That's a caricature. The reality is that our sin, our rejection of God, separates us from him, which also separates us from joy and wisdom and love and anything else that is good. The full absence of God's presence is what hell is. The Bible often uses fire as imagery for hell, but what does fire do? It disintegrates. It disintegrates, and that's what happens. In this life, we all see that our self-centeredness disintegrates. We see it in ourselves, we see it in others. Selfishness leads to bitterness and envy and anxiety and denial, and that happens. You know, you live 70, 80, 90 years if you get a good innings, and that's what happens in this life. But what if your life extends into eternity? If you're a bitter person, for example, what does bitterness look like extended into 1,000 years? What does it look like extended into 10,000 years? Hell is less about a place that God just sends you off and more about the trajectory of a self-absorbed life. It's the trajectory. It's your freely chosen identity apart from God and mine. C.S. Lewis wrote a book, you know C.S. Lewis, the Narnia guy, he wrote a book called The Great Divorce, and The Great Divorce is about a busload of people who go and visit heaven from hell. So they all live in hell, they go and visit heaven. And the way that he describes the people on the bus is amazing, because they're all extreme versions of what people can be like in this life, because it's magnified over years. And Lewis writes this: hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining, always blaming others, but initially you are still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish that you could stop it. But there'll come a day when you can no longer. It's not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us, there is something growing which will be hell unless it's nipped in the bud. Hell is miserable because it's unchecked pride and self-pity and certainty that everybody else is wrong, stretched out forever. So does God send people there? In a sense, yes, he certainly does, but actually not against their will. The people on the bus going to hell would rather have their version of freedom than submit to God. In the end, all God does is give everybody what they most want, even if it includes freedom away from him. Lewis writes it like this: there are only two kinds of people, those who say, thy will be done to God, or those to whom God finally says, thy will be done. All that are in hell choose it. Really interesting. Ever thought of it that way before? Of course, if you ask anybody, do you want to go to hell, they'll say no. Of course they will. But that's not the question. The real question is, do you at the bottom of your soul want to be with God, or do you want to be away from him? Because you'll get whichever one of those you want in the final account. So there's a clear dividing line. It's not based on rules, it's based on relationship, but there is a very clear dividing line. And then thirdly, there's no greater justice. There's no greater justice than God's judgment. At the end of Nahum, he writes this. King of Assyria, your shepherds slumber, your nobles lie down to rest. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. Nothing can heal you, your wound is fatal. All who hear the news about you clap their hands at your fall, for who has not felt your endless cruelty? So these verses speak very directly to the king of Assyria, the leader, in very strong terms. There's no escape. But Nahum also refers to who's looking on. When word gets out that Assyria has fallen, nobody's going to be upset in the rest of the world. Those who have suffered will be glad it's all over. In other words, when all is done and dusted, those who know the truth will look on and agree with what God did. There'll be no complaints from bystanders. Assyria did eventually fall, we think in about 612 BC, a few years after Nahum spoke. So the way God does justice is entirely fair. As we said earlier, one of the reasons we don't like the idea of judgment is we don't want to be misjudged. We don't want to be unfairly blamed. That absolutely will not happen with God. His judgment is 100% fair because he's not judging you or me or our country or anyone else, you know, like everybody else does, sort of piecing bits together, doing some guesswork. He knows. He knows. He knows when everyone else thinks that you're brilliant, but you know that you've tricked them in some way. He knows when you don't even realize when you're being selfish or arrogant or proud. You and I only see the tip of the iceberg in our own lives. If we knew the depth of what God knows about us, we'd feel sick. I believe that. We'd feel sick. God sees the whole, so his judgment is completely fair. We can have no complaint whatsoever. He will ensure that justice is done. It's in his nature. Wrongs will be righted. Debts will be called in. Everything that should be paid for somehow will be. All those who raped and murdered and got away with it, justice will be done. Those who lied and stole, justice will be done. Those who abused and misused, justice will be done. Every wrong thought, word, deed committed by every person in every time, in every place, will be accounted for. It will. It's going to happen. And this is a good thing. This is a good thing. For eternity, there'll be no loose ends. Nobody who got away with it, so to speak, in this life will do so forever. Whether it's the Holocaust or slave trading, or whether it's that I said something unkind to my kids, or I didn't listen to somebody because I thought they were unimportant, whatever it is, God knows about it, he cares about it, and he will administer justice. It will be done. And those are the last verses of the book of Nahum. Great finish, isn't it? As I said before, in the Old Testament, there's loads of texts like this. You can't get away from it. But Nahum is the only one, it's the only one where there isn't really a hint of hope. He doesn't throw us an olive branch. And that's deliberate. I think the reason this little book is in the Bible is to say, eventually it will come crashing down. Your little empire will come crashing down. Yes, God is loving, he's merciful, he'll do anything to get you. But if you choose to permanently exclude him, the day will come when he will let you continue on that course forever. People want choice, don't they? We love choice in our culture. And in this, God says, I love you, and it's the wrong choice, but if you're choosing away from me, I'll let you. I'll let you. So how's everybody feeling? What we're talking about today is really hard stuff. It is. Doesn't make it not true, but it is hard stuff. And I think this is stuff that God wants us to hear. We aren't the Assyrians, but this is the same God. Our sin is serious. I don't say this lightly, but I actually do hope that this subject has unsettled you a bit. The Bible is full of warnings about the judgment of God for a reason. We shouldn't try to dress them up. Judgment is coming, but that's not the end of it. Before we see why, let me tell you a story about a time when I enjoyed being judged. Really. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was thinking about doing some more study part-time. And I wanted to do a master's in theology, but the options were all really expensive and I'm really cheap. And so I was doing some research, and I looked at London School of Theology's website, and they were running a competition to win a course of your choice, 100% funded. I thought, okay, I'll enter that then. And you had to write an essay and send it in, and so I did that. And then a few months later, they got in touch and said, oh, you've been shortlisted with two other people. I thought, yes, brilliant. So far, so good. And the final bit of the competition was to do a short talk to all their graduates that year. So there's like hundreds of people in this big marquee with a panel of judges. I had no idea what to expect. I know everybody was in there. And then it was time to do the talks. And what was great is the two other shortlisted people went first. I was third. They went first. So they did their talks. And then I got up. And I was almost certain I was going to win. Reason being, I knew I was going to answer the question and they didn't. So I got up pretty confident. I don't know, I wasn't certain, but I was pretty confident when I got up. So I got up, I delivered my little talk, and they said, oh, the decision making on this, the judges will take a little while. So Naomi and I went out of the big marquee, we went off and got a burger. And while we weren't even in the room, they announced to everybody that I'd won, which was brilliant. I got to do my master's entirely for free. But it was a bit disappointing that I wasn't there for the proclamation of my victory. That would have been nice. When you're being judged and the verdict is positive, you want to be there, don't you? You want to be there. It feels great. If you've ever won a competition or you got a good school report or you even got some good results back from the doctor that you maybe weren't sure about, it's a great feeling. Judgment is actually something to look forward to. It's something great if the result is a big thumbs up. Is it not? So here's the thing. Despite all the stuff that we've looked at, there's no greater rescuer. There's no greater rescuer. The big thing to lift us out of depression or even terror around judgment is this. While it's coming and it's fair and there's no greater justice, there's also no greater rescuer. There's no greater rescuer. And let me just say this. Some people sort of try and push God's judgment out of the picture by saying it's not a thing. Some people who even call themselves Christians say, well, God doesn't judge. He's too nice. He's too nice. He's too loving. They turn God into a weak and pointless cosmic teddy bear. The real God absolutely judges. He does. But his love is worth something because it costs him dearly to rescue us in the face of that judgment. In Jesus, God found a way, despite what we're like, where judgment will happen and justice will be done, and he will look at all of us knowing the complete truth, and yet despite all our wrongdoing, all the ways we make God our enemy, the verdict will be a resounding thumbs up because of what Jesus did on the cross. The sin of every murderer and rapist and abuser and liar and boaster, you and me, every person, in every moment, it'll all be accounted for, and yet on the cross, Jesus still sets us free. Here's a great image. When a New Testament, written years after Nahum, with hindsight about what Jesus had done, talks about our judgment, it sometimes uses language like it's in a courtroom. Imagine God the Father is the judge, and he's got the wig on and the garb, and he's got the big hammer and everything. And Jesus is the lawyer representing you and me. He's our advocate. When you imagine Jesus defending you in court, so to speak, imagine what he says. How does he know? How does he behave? And I used to imagine it went something like this when Jesus represented me to his Father. I used to imagine that Jesus would speak like this. He'd walk into court and say, Father, I'm here to represent Matt, and I know he's been a bad boy again. He keeps sinning against you, and in your righteous judgment, he should be on his way to hell. But you're gracious and loving, and seeing as it's me, your son, representing him, why don't you let him off one last time? Go on, nudge, nudge. That's how I used to imagine God judging me, even with Jesus as my advocate. Like it's some sort of touch and go as my list of misdemeanors goes up and up and up and up. But that isn't how it goes. That isn't what happens. The cross means it's far more powerful than that. Because Jesus has died and risen again, and I've trusted him, when Jesus represents me in the cosmic courtroom, he's not on the defensive pleading for my freedom and it's hanging by a thread. Jesus can say something more like this. He can say, yes, Father, it's true that Matt has done and thought all sorts of bad things. He's caused loads of damage. He's earned hell. In fact, sometimes it seems like he's trying to get there. Nobody denies these facts. But the debt he owes is paid because I've paid it. So not only do I have a strong case to make, but on the basis of my own blood, I don't just ask that Matt is set free. I demand it. I demand it. There is no case to answer because it's already settled. The bill is paid. Let's get out of court. That's the reality. Do you see? God doesn't just release us from our debt because he's being nice. It's actually now justice for him to do so. If you trust Jesus, it would actually be unjust. It would be criminal for God to inflict wrath on you. It won't happen. It won't happen. If God will do what he does in Jesus to get me, do I have to worry about being judged by him? No. Because I already know the outcome. And it's not overconfidence, because it's not me that I'm trusting. I can't boast about it. I can just enjoy it. Jesus takes the righteous anger of God on himself. He subs in for us. If God will do what he does in Jesus to get me, I have no thing to worry about at all. Now, of course, there's eternal consequences to this. This is massive stuff. There is no more massive thing than this, really, is there? But think about what this means in the everyday. A lot of Christians, I think, walk around with the constant feeling that God is a bit disappointed with them. Could do better. He's a bit disappointed. But that can't make sense. It can't make sense. The only thing that would disappoint God is sin. And he's not just disappointed with sin, he's furious. It invites his wrath and his judgment. But I said earlier, God's anger is predictable. That's the only thing he's angry at, sin. But if you've trusted Jesus, God looks at you and sees him, which means he's always delighted with you. He's always delighted with you. He's not a sort of frothy, ambivalent in between, depends on how you've been this week. No, no, no. He's delighted with you. And if that sounds too good to be true, you're on the way to seeing the truth about Jesus in a way that you never have before. That's the truth. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, you're probably thinking you came the wrong week. You're really welcome as always. We want you to feel comfortable in general, but you should be concerned about God's judgment. It's coming. There's a division line and it's fair. You might die tomorrow, you might die in 20 years, but it's coming. And it's not because God is out to get you. It's because you've already got yourself away from him. He's not out to get you, but it doesn't have to be that way. He loves you and his son died for you and he's waiting for you to turn away from all the other nonsense and trust him and make him the center. And you can do it any time. So this little book of Nahum, I imagine we won't look at it again in church for quite a while. But I hope you give it a read sometime. If you do, remember this. Nahum's there to make us feel the weight of God's judgment, to shudder in amazement and gratitude at what Jesus has released us from. Our sin is so great that he had to die for us. But he loves us so much, he actually wanted to. He actually wanted to. Let me pray. Father, you are the good judge. You know all things. You judge fairly. And yet love is your modus operandi. It's the way of your way of being. You extend love to us. You free us. You release us. And we want to take hold of that in a new way. We don't want to shirk away from the reality that you judge all things. We actually want to embrace it. We know that it's a good thing because it comes from you. For any of us here this morning who don't yet know you, we pray that you would click something into gear this morning, that your spirit would react in people's hearts. Convict, not condemn. Convict of sin, of our need for you. I pray that for all of us though, Lord. All of us need you. All of us have no idea the depth of our wrongdoing, of our rejection, and yet we also have absolutely no idea of your love for us and how much exactly it cost Jesus to do that. Thank you that in him we don't need to fear judgment. Thank you that in him we're free.